together, getting rid of the rock just to keep from being called for traveling. There were phrases for that sort of run, the most common being in the zone. But the one Big Jim liked was feeling it, as in, she's really feeling it now. As though the game had some divine texture beyond the reach of ordinary players, although sometimes even ordinary players felt it and were transformed for a brief while into gods and goddesses, every bodily defect seeming to disappear during their transitory divinity. A texture that, on special nights, could be touched. Some rich and marvelous drape such as must adorn the hardwood halls of Valhalla. Hannah Compton had never played her junior year. The championship game had been her valedictory. That summer, while driving drunk, her father had killed himself, his wife, and all three daughters while driving back to Tarker's Mills from Brownies, where they had gone for ice cream fraps. The bonus Cadillac had been their coffin. The multiple fatality crash had been front-page news in Western Maine. Julia Shumway's Democrat published an issue with a black border that week. But Big Jim had not been grief-stricken. Hannah never would have played college ball, he suspected. There the girls were bigger, and she might have been reduced to role-player status. She never would have stood for that. Her hate had to be fed by constant action on the floor. Big Jim understood completely. He sympathized completely. It was the main reason he had never even considered leaving the mill. In the wider world, he might have made more money, but wealth was the short beer of existence. Power was champagne. Running the mill was good on ordinary days, but in times of crisis, it was better than good. In times like that, you could fly on the pure wings of intuition, knowing that you couldn't screw up, absolutely couldn't. You could read the defense even before the defense had coalesced, and you scored every time you got the ball. You were feeling it, and there was no better time for that to happen than in a championship game. This was his championship game, and everything was breaking his way. He had the sense, the total belief, that nothing could go wrong during this magical passage. Even things that seem wrong would become opportunities rather than stumbling blocks. Like Hannah's desperation half-court shot that had brought the whole Derry Civic Center to its feet. The Mills fans cheering, the Castle Rockers raving in disbelief. Feeling it. Which was why he wasn't tired, even though he should have been exhausted. Which was why he wasn't worried about Junior, in spite of Junior's reticence and pale watchfulness. Which was why he wasn't worried about Dale Barbara and Barbara's troublesome coterie of friends, most notably the newspaper bitch. Which was why, when Peter Randolph and Andy Sanders looked at him dumbfounded, Big Jim only smiled. He could afford to smile. He was feeling it. "Close the supermarket?" Andy asked. "Won't that get a lot of people upset, Big Jim?" "Supermarket. And the gas and grocery," Big Jim corrected, still smiling. "Brownies we don't have to worry about. It's already closed. Good thing, too. It's a dirty little place." "Selling dirty little magazines," he did not add. "Jim, there's still plenty of supplies at Food City," Randolph said. "I spoke to Jack Cale about that just this afternoon. Meat's thin, but everything else is holding up."
"I know that," Big Jim said. "I understand inventory, and Cale does, too. He should. He's Jewish, after all."
"Well, I'm just saying everything's been orderly so far, because people keep their pantries well-stocked." He brightened. "Now I could see ordering shorter hours at Food City. I think Jack could be talked into that. He's probably already thinking ahead to it."
Big Jim shook his head, still smiling. Here was another example of how things broke your way when you were feeling it. Duke Perkins would have said it was a mistake to put the town under any extra stress, especially after this night's unsettling celestial event. Duke was dead, however, and that was more than convenient. It was divine.
"Closed up," he repeated. "Both of them. Tight as ticks. And when they reopen, we'll be the ones handing out supplies. Stuff will last longer and the distribution will be fairer. I'll announce a rationing plan at the Thursday meeting." He paused. "If the dome isn't gone by then, of course."
Andy said hesitantly, "I'm not sure we have the authority to close down businesses, Big Jim."
In a crisis like this, we not only have the authority, we have the responsibility.
He clapped Pete Randolph heartily on the back. The mill's new chief wasn't expecting it and gave out a startled squeak.
What if it starts a panic?
Andy was frowning.
Well, that's a possibility, Big Jim said. When you kick a nest of mice, they're all apt to come running out. We may have to increase the size of our police force quite a bit if this crisis doesn't end soon.
Yes, quite a bit. Randolph looked startled. We're going on 20 officers now, including... He cocked his head toward the door.
Yep, Big Jim said. And speaking of those fellers, better bring them in, Chief, so we can finish this and send them home to bed. I think they're going to have a busy day tomorrow. And if they get roughed up a little, so much the better. They deserve it for not being able to keep their jack handles in their pants.
2. Frank, Carter, Mel, and Georgia shuffled in like suspects onto a police lineup stage. Their faces were set and defiant, but the defiance was thin. Hannah Compton would have laughed at it. Their eyes were down, studying their shoes. It was clear to Big Jim that they expected to be fired or worse. And that was just fine with him. Fright was the easiest of emotions to work with.
Well, he said, here are the brave officers.
Georgia Rue muttered something under her breath.
Speak up, honey bunch. Big Jim cupped a hand to his ear.
Said we didn't do nothing wrong, she said.
Still in that teacher's being mean to me mumble. Then exactly what did you do?
And when Georgia, Frank, and Carter all started to talk at once, he pointed at Frankie.
You. And make it good, for gosh sake.
We were out there, Frank said, but she invited us.
Right.
Georgia cried, folding her arms below her considerable bosom.
She...
Shut it.
Big Jim pointed a hammy finger at her. One speaks for all. That's how it works when you're a team. Are you a team? Carter Thibodeau saw where this was going.
Yes, sir, Mr. Rennie.
Glad to hear it.
Big Jim nodded for Frank to go on.
She said she had some beers,
Frank said. That's the only reason we went out. Can't buy it in town, as you know. Anyway, we were sitting around, drinking beers, just a can each, and we were pretty much off duty.
Completely off duty, the chief put in. Isn't that what you meant?
Frank nodded respectfully.
Yes, sir, that's what I meant to say. We drank our beers, and then said we'd better go. But she said she appreciated what we were doing, every one of us, and wanted to say thank you. Then she kind of spread her legs.
Showing her woofer, you know,
Mel clarified with a large and vacant smile. Big Jim winced and gave silent thanks that Andrea Grinnell wasn't here. Dope addict or not, she could have gone all politically correct in a situation like this.
She took us in the bedroom one by one, Frankie said.
I know, it was a bad decision, and we're all sorry, but it was purely voluntary on her part.
I'm sure it was, Chief Randolph said. That girl has quite a reputation. Her husband, too. You didn't see any drugs out there, did you?
No, sir. A four-part chorus. And you didn't hurt her?
Big Jim asked. I understand she's claiming she was punched around and whatnot.
Nobody hurt her, Carter said.
Can I say what I think happened?
Big Jim flapped an assenting hand. He was beginning to think that Mr. Thibodeau had possibilities.
She probably fell down after we left. Maybe a couple of times.
She was pretty drunk. Child welfare should take that kid away from her before she kills it.
No one picked up on that.
In the town's current situation, the child welfare office in Castle Rock might as well have been on the moon.
So basically, you're all clean,
Big Jim said. As a whistle, Frank replied.
Well, I think we're satisfied.
Big Jim looked around.
Are we satisfied, gentlemen?
Andy and Randolph nodded, looking relieved.
Good, Big Jim said. Now, it's been a long day, an eventful day, and we all need some sleep, I'm sure.
You young officers especially need it because you'll report back for duty at 7 a.m. tomorrow. The supermarket and the gas and grocery are both going to be closed for the duration of this crisis. And Chief Randolph thought that you'd be just the ones to guard Food City in case the people who show up there don't take kindly to the new order of things. Think you're up to that, Mr. Thibodeau, with your war wound? Carter flexed his arm. I'm okay. Her dog didn't rip the tendon none. We can put Fred Denton with them, too, Chief Randolph said, getting into the spirit of the thing. Weddington and Morrison at the gas and grocery should be enough. Jim, Andy said, maybe we should put the more experienced officers at Food City and the less experienced ones at the smaller... I don't think so, Big Jim said, smiling, feeling it. These young folks are the ones we want at Food City, the very ones. And another thing, a little bird told me that some of you folks have been carrying weapons in your cars, and a couple have even been wearing them on foot patrol. Silence greeted this. You're probationary officers, Big Jim said. If you've got personal handguns, that's your right as Americans, but if I hear that any of you are strapped while standing out in front of Food City tomorrow and dealing with the good folks of this town, your police officer days are over.
Absolutely right, Randolph said.
Big Jim surveyed Frank, Carter, Mel, and Georgia. Any problems with that? Any of you? They didn't look happy about it. Big Jim hadn't expected that they would be, but they were getting off easy. Thibodeau kept flexing his shoulder and his fingers, testing them. What if they weren't loaded? Frank asked. What if they were just there, you know, as a warning? Big Jim raised a teacherly finger. I'm going to tell you what my father told me, Frank. There's no such thing as an unloaded gun. We've got a good town here. They'll behave. That's what I'm banking on. If they change, we'll change. Got it?
Yes, sir, Mr. Rennie.
Frank didn't sound happy about it. That was fine with Big Jim. He rose, only instead of leading them out, Big Jim extended his hands. He saw their hesitation and nodded, still smiling. Come on now. Tomorrow's going to be a big day, and we don't want to let this one go without a word of prayer. So grab on. They grabbed on. Big Jim closed his eyes and bowed his head. Dear Lord. It went on for some time. 3. Barbie mounted the outside steps to his apartment at a few minutes to midnight, his shoulders sagging with weariness, thinking that the only thing in the world he wanted was 6 hours of oblivion before answering the alarm and going up to Sweet Briar Rose to cook breakfast. The weariness left him as soon as he snapped on the lights, which, courtesy of Andy Sanders' generator, still worked. Someone had been in here. The sign was so subtle that at first he couldn't isolate it. He closed his eyes, then opened them and let them swing casually about his combination living room kitchenette, trying to take in everything. The books he'd been planning to leave behind hadn't been moved around on the shelves. The chairs were where they had been, one under the lamp and the other by the room's only window, with its scenic view of the alley outside. The coffee cup and the toast plate were still in the dish drainer beside the tiny sink. Then it clicked home, as such things usually did if you didn't push too hard. It was the rug. What he thought of as his Not Lindsay rug. About 5 feet long and 2 wide, Not Lindsay was a repeating diamond pattern in blue, red, white, and brown. He had bought it in Baghdad, but had been assured by an Iraqi policeman he trusted that it was of Kurdish manufacture. Very old, very beautiful, the policeman had said. His name was Latif Abd al-Khalik Hassan, a good troop. Look, Turkey, but no. Big grin, white teeth. A week after that day in the marketplace, a sniper's bullet had blown Latif Abd al-Khalik Hassan's brains right out through the back of his head. Not Turkey, Iraqi. The rug merchant wore a yellow t-shirt that had said, "Don't shoot me, I'm only the piano player." Latif listened to him nodding. They laughed together. Then the merchant had made a startlingly American jack-off gesture, and they laughed even harder. What was that about? Barbie had asked. He says, American senator bought 5 like these. Lindsey Graham. 5 rug, $500. 500 out front for press.
More on the down low, but all Senator Rugg fake. Yes, 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 this one not fake. This one real. I, Latif Hassan, tell you this, Barbie. Not Lindsey Graham Rugg.
Latif had raised his hand and Barbie slapped him five. That had been a good day. Hot but good. He had bought the rug for $200 American and an All Territories Kobe DVD player. Not Lindsey was his one souvenir of Iraq, and he never stepped on it. He always stepped around it. He had planned to leave it behind when he left the mill. He supposed down deep his idea had been to leave Iraq behind when he left the mill. But fat chance of that. Wherever you went, there you were. The great Zen truth of the age. He hadn't stepped on it. He was superstitious about that. He always detoured around it, as if to step on it would activate some computer in Washington and he would find himself back in Baghdad or fucking Fallujah. But somebody had, because not Lindsey was Must. Wrinkled and a little crooked. It had been perfectly straight when he left this morning, 1,000 years ago. He went into the bedroom. The coverlet was as neat as always, but that sense that someone had been here was equally strong. Was it a lingering smell of sweat? Some psychic vibe? Barbie didn't know and didn't care. He went to his dresser, opened the top drawer, and saw that the pair of extra faded jeans which had been on top of the pile was now on the bottom. And his khaki shorts, which he'd laid in with the zippers up, were now zippers down. He went immediately to the second drawer and the socks. It took less than 5 seconds to verify that his dog tags were gone, and he wasn't surprised. No, not surprised at all. He grabbed the disposable cell he had also been planning to leave behind and went back into the main room. The combined Tarkers-Chesters telephone directory was sitting on a table by the door, a book so skinny it was almost a pamphlet. He looked for the number he wanted, not really expecting it to be there. Chiefs of police did not make a practice of listing their home phone numbers. Except, it seemed, in small towns, they did. At least this one had, although the listing was discreet. H. and B. Perkins, 28 Morin Street. Even though it was now past midnight, Barbie punched in the number without hesitation. He couldn't afford to wait. He had an idea that time might be extremely short. 4. Her phone was tweeting. Howie, no doubt, calling to tell her he was going to be late, to just lock up the house and go to bed. Then it came down on her again, like unpleasant presence raining from a poisoned piñata, the realization that Howie was dead. She didn't know who could be calling her at, she checked her watch, 20 past midnight, but it wasn't Howie. She winced as she sat up, rubbing her neck, cursing herself for falling asleep on the couch, also cursing whoever had wakened her at such an ungodly hour, and refreshed her recollection of her strange new singularity. Then it occurred to her that there could be only one reason for such a late call. The dome was either gone or had been breached. She bumped her leg on the coffee table hard enough to make the papers there rattle, then limped to the phone beside Howie's chair. How it hurt her to look at that empty chair. And snatched it up.
What? What?
It's Dale Barbara.
Bobby? Has it broken? Has the dome broken?
No, I wish that's why I was calling, but it's not.
Then why? It's almost 12:30 in the morning.
You said your husband was investigating Jim Rennie. Brenda paused, getting the sense of this. She had put her palm against the side of her throat, the place where Howie had caressed her for the last time.
He was, but I told you, he had no absolute...
I remember what you said, Barbie told her. You need to listen to me, Brenda. Can you do that? Are you awake?
I am now.
Your husband had notes?
Yes, on his laptop. I printed them.
She was looking at the Vader file, spread out on the coffee table.
Good.
Tomorrow morning I want you to put the printout in an envelope and take it to Julia Shumway. Tell her to put it in a safe place. An actual safe, if she's got one. A cash strongbox or a locked file cabinet if she doesn't. Tell her she's only to open it if something happens to you, or me, or both of us.
You're scaring me.
She is not to open it otherwise. If you tell her that, will she do it? My instincts say she will.
Of course she will, but why not let her look?
Because if the editor of the local paper sees what your husband had on Big Jim and Big Jim knows she's seen it, most of the leverage we have will be gone. Do you follow that?
Yes.
She found herself wishing desperately that Howie were the one having this post-midnight conversation. I said I might be arrested today if the missile strike didn't work. Do you remember me telling you that?
Of course.
Well, I wasn't. That fat son of a bitch knows how to bide his time. But he won't bide it much longer. I'm almost positive it's going to happen tomorrow. Later today, I mean. If, that is, you can't put a stop to it by threatening to air whatever dirt your husband dug up.
What do you think they're going to arrest you for?
No idea, but it won't be shoplifting. And once I'm in jail, I think I might have an accident. I saw plenty of accidents like that in Iraq.
That's crazy.
But it had the horrid plausibility she had sometimes experienced in nightmares. Think about it, Brenda. Rennie has something to cover up, he needs a scapegoat, and the new police chief is in his pocket. The stars are in alignment.
I was planning to go see him anyway, Brenda said, and I was going to take Julia with me for safety's sake.
Don't take Julia, he said, but don't go alone.
You don't actually think he'd...
I don't know what he'd do, how far he'd go. Who do you trust besides Julia? She flashed back to that afternoon. The fire's almost out, standing beside Little Bitch Road, feeling good in spite of her grief, because she was flush with endorphins. Romeo Burpee telling her she ought to at least stand for fire chief.
Romeo Burpee, she said.
Okay, then he's the one.
Do I tell him what Howie had on...
No, Barbie said. He's just your insurance policy. And here's another one. Lock up your husband's laptop.
Okay, but if I lock up the laptop and leave the printout with Julia, what am I going to show Jim?
I guess I could print a second copy.
No, one of those floating around is enough, for now at least. Putting the fear of God into him is one thing. Freaking him out would make him too unpredictable.
Brenda, do you believe he's dirty?
She did not hesitate. With all my heart.
Because Howie believed it, and that's good enough for me.
And you remember what's in the file?
Not the exact figures and the names of all the banks they use, but enough.
Then he'll believe you, Barbie said, with or without a second copy of the paperwork. He'll believe you.
5. Brenda put the Vader file in a manila envelope. On the front, she printed Julia's name. She put the envelope on the kitchen table, then went into Howie's study and locked his laptop in the safe. The safe was small, and she had to turn the Mac on its side. But in the end, it just fit. She finished by giving the combination dial not just one but two spins, as per her dead husband's instructions. As she did, the lights went out. For a moment, some primitive part of her was certain she had blown them just by giving the dial that extra spin. And then she realized that the generator out back had died.
6.
When Junior came in at 6:05 on Tuesday morning, his pale cheeks stubbly, his hair standing up in haystacks, Big Jim was sitting at the kitchen table in a white bathrobe, the approximate size of a clipper ship's mainsail. He was drinking a Coke. Junior nodded at it.
A good day starts with a good breakfast.
Big Jim raised the can, took a swallow, and set it down.
There's no coffee. Well, there is, but there's no electricity. The generator's out of LP. Grab yourself a pop, why don't you? They're still fairly cold. And you look like you could use it.
Junior opened the fridge and peered into its dark interior.
Am I supposed to believe you couldn't score some bottled gas any time you wanted it?
Big Jim started a little at that, then relaxed. It was a reasonable question and didn't mean Junior knew anything. The guilty man flees where none pursueth, Big Jim reminded himself.
Let's just say it might not be politic at this point in time.
Uh-huh. Junior closed the refrigerator door and sat down on the other side of the table. He looked at his old man with a certain hollow amusement, which Big Jim mistook for affection. The family that slays together stays together, Junior thought. At least for the time being. As long as it's...
politic, he said.
Big Jim nodded and studied his son, who was supplementing his early morning beverage with a big jerk beef stick. He did not ask, where have you been? He did not ask, what's wrong with you? Although it was obvious in the unforgiving first light that flooded the kitchen that something was. But he did have a question. There are bodies, plural, is that right?
Yes.
Junior took a big bite of his beef stick and washed it down with Coke. The kitchen was weirdly silent without the hum of the fridge and the burble of the Mr. Coffee.
And all these bodies can be laid at Mr. Barbara's door.
Yes.
All.
Another chomp, another swallow. Junior looking at him steadily, rubbing his left temple as he did so.
Can you plausibly discover those bodies around noon today?
No prob.
And the evidence against our Mr. Barbara, of course.
Yes, Junior smiled. It's good evidence.
Don't report to the police station this morning, son.
I better, Junior said. It might look funny if I don't. Besides, I'm not tired. I slept with... He shook his head. I slept. Leave it at that. Big Jim also did not ask, who did you sleep with? He had other concerns than whom his son might be diddling. He was just glad the boy hadn't been among the fellows who'd done their business with that nasty piece of trailer trash out on Motton Road. Doing business with that sort of girl was a good way to catch something and get sick.
He's already sick, a voice in Big Jim's head whispered.
It might have been the fading voice of his wife.
Just look at him.
That voice was probably right, but this morning he had greater concerns than Junior Rennie's eating disorder, or whatever it was.
I didn't say go to bed. I want you on motor patrol, and I want you to do a job for me. Just stay away from Food City while you're doing it. There's going to be trouble there, I think.
Junior's eyes livened up.
What kind of trouble?
Big Jim didn't answer directly.
Can you find Sam Verdreau?
Sure, he'll be in that little shack out on God Creek Road.
Ordinarily, he'd be sleeping it off, but today he's more apt to be shaking himself awake with the DTs.
Junior snickered at this image, then winced, and went back to rubbing his temple.
You really think I'm the person to talk to him? He's not my biggest fan right now. He's probably even deleted me from his Facebook page.
I don't understand.
It's a joke, Dad. Forget it.
Do you think he'd warm up to you if you offered him 3 quarts of whiskey? And more later if he does a good job?
That skanky old bastard would warm up to me if I offered him half a juice glass of 2-buck chuck.
You can get the whiskey from Brownies, Big Jim said.
In addition to cheap-ass groceries and beaver books, Brownies was one of 3 agency liquor stores in the mill, and the PD had keys to all 3. Big Jim slid the key across the table.
Back door. Don't let anyone see you going in.
What's Sloppy Sam supposed to do for the booze?
Big Jim explained. Junior listened impassively, except for his bloodshot eyes, which danced. He had only one more question.
Would it work?
Big Jim nodded.
It will. I'm feeling it.
Junior took another chomp on his beef stick and another swallow of his soda.
So am I, Dad, he said.
So am I.
7. When Junior was gone, Big Jim went into his study with his robe billowing grandly around him. He took his cell phone from the center drawer of his desk, where he kept it as much as possible. He thought they were godless things that did nothing but encourage a lot of loose and useless talk. How many man-hours had been lost to useless gabble on these things? And what kind of nasty rays did they shoot into your head while you were gabbling? Still, they could come in handy. He reckoned that Sam Verdreau would do as Junior told him, but he also knew it would be foolish not to take out insurance. He selected a number in the cell phone's hidden directory, which could be accessed only via numeric code. The phone rang 6 times before it was picked up.
What?
The sire of the multitudinous Killian brood barked. Big Jim winced and held the phone away from his ear for a second. When he put it back, he heard low clucking sounds in the background.
Are you in the chicken house, Raj?
Ah, yes, sir, Big Jim, I sure am. Chickens gotta be fed, come hella high water.
A 180-degree turn from irritation to respect. And Roger Killian ought to be respectful. Big Jim had made him a gosh-darn millionaire. If he was wasting what could have been a good life with no financial worries by still getting up at dawn to feed a bunch of chickens, that was God's will. Roger was too dumb to stop. It was his heaven-sent nature, and would no doubt serve Big Jim well today. And the town, he thought. It's the town I'm doing this for, the good of the town. Roger, I've got a job for you and your three oldest sons.
Only got two to hum.
Roger said, in his thick Yankee accent, home came out hum.
Rick and Randall are here, but Roland was in Oxford buying feed when the Christing Dome came down.
He paused and considered what he had just said. In the background, the chickens clucked.
Sorry about the profanity.
I'm sure God forgives you, Big Jim said. You and your two oldest, then. Can you get them to town by... Big Jim calculated it didn't take long when you were feeling it. Few decisions did. Say 9 o'clock, 9:15 at the latest.
I'll have to rouse them, but sure, Roger said. What are we doing? Bringing in some of the extra propane?
No, Big Jim said, and you hush about that, God love you. Just listen. Big Jim talked. Roger Killian, God love him, listened. In the background, roughly 800 chickens clucked as they stuffed themselves with steroid-laced feed. 8.
What? What? Why?
Jack Cale was sitting at his desk in the cramped little Food City manager's office. The desk was littered with inventory lists he and Ernie Calvert had finally completed at 1 in the morning. Their hopes of finishing earlier dashed by the meteor shower. Now he swept them up, handwritten on long, yellow legal pad sheets, and shook them at Peter Randolph, who stood in the office doorway. The new chief had dolled up in full uniform for this visit.
Look at these, Pete, before you do something foolish.
Sorry, Jack. Market's closed. It'll reopen on Thursday as a food depot. Share and share alike. We'll keep all the records. Food City Corps won't lose a cent, I promise you.
That's not the point!
Jack nearly groaned. He was a baby-faced 30-something with a thatch of wiry red hair he was currently torturing with the hand not holding out the yellow sheets, which Peter Randolph showed no signs of taking.
Here, here, what in the name of jumped-up Jack Sprat Jesus are you talking about, Peter Randolph?
Ernie Calvert came barreling up from the basement storage area. He was broad-bellied and red-faced, his gray hair mowed into the crew cut he'd worn all his life. He was wearing a green Food City duster.
He wants to close the market, Jack said.
Why in God's name would you want to do that when there's still plenty of food?
Ernie asked angrily.
Why would you want to go scaring people like that? They'll be plenty scared in time if this goes on. What dumb idea was this?
Selectmen voted, Randolph said. Any problems you have with the plan, take them up at the special town meeting on Thursday night. If this isn't over by then, of course.
What plan? Ernie shouted. Are you telling me Andrea Grinnell was in favor of this? She knows better.
I understand she's got the flu, Randolph said. Flat on her back, so Andy decided. Big Jim seconded the decision. No one had told him to put it this way. No one had to. Randolph knew how Big Jim liked to do business.
Rationing might make sense at some point, Jack said, but why now?
He shook the sheets again, his cheeks almost as red as his hair.
Why? When we've still got so much.
That's the best time to start conserving, Randolph said.
That's rich, coming from a man with a powerboat on Sebago Lake and a Winnebago Vectra in his dooryard, Jack said.
Don't forget Big Jim's Hummer, Ernie put in.
Enough, Randolph said. The selectmen decided.
Well, two of them did, Jack said.
You mean one of them did, Ernie said, and we know which one.
And I carried the message, so there's an end to it. Put a sign in the window. Market closed until further notice.
Pete, look, be reasonable.
Ernie no longer seemed angry. Now he seemed almost to be pleading.
That'll scare the dickens out of people. If you're set on this, how about I put close for inventory, we'll reopen soon. Maybe add sorry for the temporary inconvenience. Put temporary in red or something.
Peter Randolph shook his head slowly and weightily. Can't let you earn. Couldn't let you, even if you were still an official employee, like him. He nodded to Jack Cale, who put down the inventory sheet so he could torture his hair with both hands. Closed until further notice. That's what the selectmen told me, and I carry out their orders. Besides, lies always come back to bite you on the ass.
Yeah, well, Duke Perkins would have told them to take this particular order and wipe their asses with it, Ernie said.
You ought to be ashamed, Pete, carrying that fat shit's water. He says jump, you ask how high. You want to shut up right now if you know what's good for you, Randolph said, pointing at him. The finger shook a little. If you don't want to spend the rest of the day in jail on a disrespect charge, you just want to close your mouth and follow orders. This is a crisis situation.
Ernie looked at him unbelievingly.
Disrespect charge? No such animal.
There is now. If you don't believe it, go on and try me.
9. Later on, much too late to do any good, Julia Shumway would piece together most of how the Food City riot started, although she never got a chance to print it. Even if she had, she would have done so as a pure news story. The 5 W's and the H. If asked to write about the emotional heart of the event, she would have been lost. How to explain that people she'd known all her life, people she respected, people she loved, had turned into a mob? She told herself, I could have gotten a better handle on it if I'd been there from the very beginning and seen how it started. But that was pure rationalization, a refusal to face the orderless, reasonless beast that can arise when frightened people are provoked. She had seen such beasts on the TV news, usually in foreign countries. She never expected to see one in her own town. And there was no need for it. This was what she kept coming back to. The town had been cut off for only 70 hours, and it was stuffed with provisions of almost every kind. Only propane gas was in mysteriously short supply. Later, she would say, it was the moment when this town finally realized what was happening. There was probably truth in the idea, but it didn't satisfy her. All she could say with complete certainty, and she said it only to herself, was that she watched her town lose its mind, and afterward she would never be the same person. Ten. The first two people to see the sign are Gina Buffalino and her friend Harriet Bigelow. Both girls are dressed in white nurses' uniforms. This was Jenny Tomlinson's idea. She felt the whites inspired more confidence among the patients than candy striper pinafores. And they look most seriously cute. They also look tired, in spite of their youthful resiliency. It has been a hard 2 days, and another is ahead of them, after a night of short sleep. They have come for candy bars. They will get enough for everyone but poor diabetic Jimmy Saroy. That's the plan. And they are talking about the meteor shower. The conversation stops when they see the sign on the door.
The market can't be closed, Gina says unbelievingly. It's Tuesday morning.
She puts her face to the glass with her hands cupped to the sides to cut the glare of the bright morning sun. While she's so occupied, Anson Wheeler drives up with Rose Twitchell riding shotgun. They have left Barbie back at Sweetbriar, finishing up the breakfast service. Rose is out of the little panel truck with her namesake painted on the side even before Anson has turned off the engine. She has a long list of staples and wants to get as much as she can as soon as she can. Then she sees, closed until further notice, posted on the door.
What the hell? I saw Jack Cale just last night, and he never said a word about this.
She's speaking to Anson, who's chugging along in her wake, but it's Gina Buffalino who answers.
It's still full of stuff, too. All the shelves are stocked.
Other people are pulling in. The market is due to open in 5 minutes, and Rose isn't the only one who planned to get an early start on her marketing. Folks from all over town woke up to find the dome still in place and decided to stock up on supplies. Asked later to explain this sudden rush of custom, Rose would say, "The same thing happens every winter when the Weather Bureau upgrades a storm warning to a blizzard warning. Sanders and Rennie couldn't have picked a worse day to pull this bullshit." Among the early arrivals are units 2 and 4 of the Chester's Mill PD. Close behind them comes Frank DeLesseps in his Nova. He's ripped off the ass, gas, or grass sticker, feeling it hardly becomes an officer of the law.
Carter and George are in 2, Mel Searles and Freddie Denton in 4. They have been parked down the street by Leclerc's Maison des Fleurs, by order of Chief Randolph. No need to get there too soon, he has instructed them. Wait until there are a dozen or so cars in the parking lot. Hey, maybe they'll just read the sign and go home. This doesn't happen, of course, just as Big Jim Rennie knew wouldn't. And the appearance of the officers, especially such young and callow ones for the most part, acts as an incitement, rather than a calmative. Rose is the first to begin haranguing them. She picks on Freddie, showing him her long list of supplies, then pointing through the window, where most of the stuff she wants is ranked neatly on the shelves. Freddie is polite to begin with, aware that people, not quite a crowd, not yet, are watching, but it's hard to keep his temper with this mouthy little pipsqueak in his face. Doesn't she realize he's only following orders? Who do you think is feeding this town, Fred? Rose asks. Anson puts a hand on her shoulder. Rose shakes it off. She knows Freddie is seeing rage instead of the deep distress she feels, but she can't help it. Do you think a Cisco truck full of supplies is just going to parachute down from the sky?
Ma'am.
Oh, can it? Since when am I ma'am to you? You've been eating blueberry pancakes and that nasty limp bacon you like at my place 4 and 5 days a week for 20 years, and calling me Rosie while you did it. But you won't be eating pancakes tomorrow unless I get some flour and some shortening and some syrup and... She breaks off. Finally, sense, thank you, God. Jack Cale is opening one of the double doors. Mel and Frank have taken up station in front of it, and he has just room to squeeze between them. The prospective shoppers, there are nearly 2 dozen now, even though the market's official opening time of 9 a.m. is still a minute away, surge forward, only to stop when Jack selects a key from the bunch on his belt and locks up again. There's a collective groan.
Why the hell did you do that? Bill Wicker calls out indignantly.
My wife sent me down for eggs.
Take it up with the selectman and Chief Randolph, Jack responds. His hair is raring every which way. He throws Frank the Lesseps a black look and fires an even blacker one at Mel Searles, who is trying unsuccessfully to suppress a grin, perhaps even his famous nyuk, nyuk, nyuk.
I know I will, but for now, I've had enough of this shit. I'm done.
He strides off through the crowd with his head down and his cheeks burning even brighter than his hair. Lissa Jameson just arriving on her bicycle. Everything on her list will fit into the milk box perched on the rear fender. Her wants are small, going on minuscule. Has to swerve to avoid him. Carter, Georgia, and Freddie are ranged in front of the large plate glass window, where Jack would have set out wheelbarrows and fertilizer on an ordinary day. Carter's fingers are band-aided, and a thicker bandage bulks under his shirt. Freddie has his hand on his gun butt as Rose Twitchell continues to chew on him, and Carter wishes he could backhand her one. His fingers are okay, but his shoulder aches a bitch. The small cluster of would-be shoppers has become a large cluster, and more cars are turning into the parking lot. Before Officer Thibodeau can really study the crowd, however, Alden Dinsmore gets into his personal space. Alden looks haggard and seems to have lost 20 pounds since the death of his son. He's wearing a black mourning band on his left arm and seems dazed.
Need to go in, son. My wife sent me to stock up on the canned.
Alden doesn't say the canned what, probably the canned everything. Or maybe he just got thinking about the empty bed upstairs, the one that will never be filled again, and the Foo Fighters poster that will never be looked at again, and the model airplane on the desk that will never be finished, and clean forgot. Sorry, Mr. Dimmesdale, Carter says. You can't do that.
It's Dinsmore, Alden says in a dazed voice.
He starts toward the doors. They are locked. No way he can get in, but Carter still gives the farmer a good hearty shove backward. For the first time, Carter has some sympathy for the teachers who used to send him to detention back in high school. It is irritating not to be minded. Also, it's hot, and his shoulder aches in spite of the 2 Percocet his mother gave him. 75 at 9 a.m. is rare in October, and the faded blue color of the sky says it will be hotter by noon, hotter still by 3 p.m. Alden stumbles backward into Gina Buffalino, and they both would fall if not for Petra Searles, no lightweight she, steadying them. Alden doesn't look angry, only puzzled.
My wife sent me for the canned, he explains to Petra.
A mutter comes from the gathering people. It's not an angry sound, not quite yet. They came for groceries, and the groceries are there, but the door is locked. Now, a man has been shoved by a high school dropout who was a car mechanic last week. Gina is looking at Carter, Mel, and Frank the Lesseps with widening eyes. She points.
Those are the guys that raped her, she tells her friend Harriet without lowering her voice. Those are the guys that raped Sammy Bushy.
The smile disappears from Mel's face. The urge to nyuk-nyuk has left him.
Shut up, he says.
At the back of the crowd, Ricky and Randall Killian have arrived in a Chevrolet Canyon pick-em-up. Sam Verdreau is not far behind, walking, of course. Sam lost his license to drive for good in 07. Gina takes a step backward, staring at Mel with wide eyes. Beside her, Alden Dinsmore hulks like a farmer robot with a dead battery.
You guys are supposed to be police, hello?
That rape stuff was nothing but a whore lie, Frank says, and you better quit yelling about it before you get arrested for disturbing the peace.
Fucking right, Georgia says.
She has moved a little closer to Carter. He ignores her. He is surveying the crowd. And that's what it is now. If 50 people make a crowd, then this is one. More coming, too. Carter wishes he had his gun. He doesn't like the hostility he's seeing. Velma Winter, who runs Brownies, or did before it closed, arrives with Tommy and Willow Anderson. Velma is a big, burly woman who combs her hair like Bobby Darin and looks like she could be the warrior queen of Dyke Nation. But she has buried two husbands, and the story you can hear at the bullshit table in Sweetbriar is that she fucked them both to death and is looking for number three at Dippers on Wednesdays. That's country karaoke night, and draws an older crowd. Now she plants herself in front of Carter, hands on her meaty hips.
Closed, huh?
She says in a businesslike voice. Let's see your paperwork. Carter is confused, and being confused makes him angry.
Back off, bitch. I don't need no paperwork. The chief sent us down here. The selectmen ordered it. It's gonna be a food depot.
Rationing? That what you mean?
She snorts. Not in my town. She shoves between Mel and Frank and starts hammering on the door.
Open up. Open up in there.
Nobody home, Frank says. You might as well quit it.
But Ernie Calvert hasn't left. He comes down the pasta, flour, and sugar aisle. Velma sees him and starts hammering louder.
Open up, Ernie. Open up.
Open up, voices from the crowd agree.
Frank looks at Mel and nods. Together, they grab Velma and muscle her 200 pounds away from the door. Georgia Rue has turned and is waving Ernie back. Ernie doesn't go. Numbfuck just stands there.
Open up!
Velma bawls.
Open up! Open up!
Tommy and Willow join her. So does Bill Wicker, the postman. So does Lissa, her face shining. All her life she has hoped to be part of a spontaneous demonstration, and here's her chance. She raises a clenched fist and begins to shake it in time. Two small shakes on open and a big one on up. Others imitate her. Open up becomes open up, open up, open up. Now they're all shaking their fists in that 2+1 rhythm. Maybe 70 people, maybe 80, and more arriving all the time. The thin blue line in front of the market looks thinner than ever. The four younger cops look toward Freddie Denton for ideas, but Freddie has no ideas. He does, however, have a gun. You better fire it into the air pretty soon, Baldy, Carter thinks, or these people are going to run us down. Two more cops, Rupert Libby and Toby Whalen, drive down Main Street from the PD, where they've been drinking coffee and watching CNN. Blowing past Julia Shumway, who is jogging along with a camera slung over her shoulder. Jackie Weddington and Henry Morrison also start toward the supermarket, but then the walkie-talkie on Henry's belt crackles. It's Chief Randolph, saying that Henry and Jackie should hold their station at the gas and grocery.
But we hear, Henry begins,
those are your orders, Randolph says, not adding that they are orders he is just passing on from a higher power. As it were.
Open up! Open up! Open up!
the crowd shaking fisted power salutes in the warm air. Still scared, but excited, too, getting into it. The chef would have looked at them and seen a bunch of tyro tweakers, needing only a Grateful Dead tune on the soundtrack to make the picture complete. The Killian boys and Sam Verdreau are working their way through the crowd. They chant. Not as protective coloration, but because that crowd molting into mob vibe is just too strong to resist. But don't bother shaking their fists. They have work to do. No one pays them any particular mind. Later, only a few people will remember seeing them at all. Nurse Ginny Tomlinson is also working her way through the crowd. She has come to tell the girls they are needed at Kathy Russell. There are new patients, one a serious case. That would be Wanda Crumley from Eastchester. The Crumleys live next to the Evanses out near the Motton town line. When Wanda went over this morning to check on Jack, she found him dead, not 20 feet from where the dome cut off his wife's hand. Jack was sprawled on his back with a bottle beside him and his brains drying on the grass. Wanda ran back to her house, crying her husband's name, and she had no more than reached him when she was felled by a coronary. Wendell Crumley was lucky not to crash his little Subaru wagon on his way to the hospital. He did 80 most of the way. Rusty is with Wanda now, but Ginny doesn't think Wanda, 50, overweight, a heavy smoker, is going to make it.
"Girls," she says, "we need you at the hospital."
"Those are the ones, Mrs. Tomlinson," Gina shouts.
She has to shout to be heard over the chanting crowd. She's pointing at the cops and beginning to cry, partly from fear and tiredness, mostly from outrage.
"Those are the ones who raped her."
This time Ginny looks beyond the uniforms and realizes Gina's right. Ginny Tomlinson isn't afflicted with Piper Libby's admittedly vile temper, but she has a temper. And there's an aggravating factor at work here. Unlike Piper, Ginny saw the bushy girl with her pants off, her vagina lacerated and swelled. Huge bruises on her thighs that couldn't be seen until the blood was washed off. Such a lot of blood. Ginny forgets about the girls being needed at the hospital. She forgets about getting them out of a dangerous and volatile situation. She even forgets about Wanda Crumley's heart attack. She strides forward, elbowing someone out of her way. It happens to be Bruce Yardley, the cashier-cum-bag boy, who is shaking his fist like everyone else, and approaches Mel and Frank. They are both studying the ever more hostile crowd, and they don't see her coming. Ginny raises both hands, looking for a moment like the bad guy surrendering to the sheriff in a western. Then she brings both hands around and slaps both young men at the same time.
"You bastards," she shouts. "How could you? How could you be so cowardly, so cat-dirt mean? You'll go to jail for this, all of you."
Mel doesn't think, just reacts. He punches her in the center of her face, breaking her glasses and her nose. She goes stumbling backward, bleeding, crying out. Her old-fashioned RN cap, shocked free of the bobby pins holding it, tumbles from her head. Bruce Yardley, the young cashier, tries to grab her and misses. Ginny hits a line of shopping carts. They go rolling like a little train. She drops to her hands and knees, crying in pain and shock. Bright drops of blood from her nose, not just broken, but shattered, begin falling on the big yellow RK of no parking zone. The crowd goes temporarily silent, shocked, as Gina and Harriet rush to where Ginny crouches. Then Lissa Jameson's voice rises, a clear, perfect soprano.
"You pig bastards!"
That's when the chunk of rock flies. The first rock thrower is never identified. It may be the only crime Sloppy Sam Verdreau ever got away with. Junior dropped him off at the upper end of town, and Sam, with visions of whiskey dancing in his head, went prospecting on the east bank of Presteel Stream for just the right rock. It had to be big, but not too big, or he wouldn't be able to throw it with any accuracy, even though once, a century ago, it seems sometimes. At others, it seems very close. He was the starting pitcher for the Mills Wildcats in the first game of the main state tourney. He had found it, at last, not far from the Peace Bridge. A pound, pound and a half, and as smooth as a goose egg. "One more thing," Junior had said as he dropped Sloppy Sam off. It wasn't Junior's one more thing, but Junior did not tell Sam this any more than Chief Randolph had told Weddington and Morrison, who had ordered them to stay on station. Wouldn't have been politic. "Aim for the chick.
That was Junior's final word to Sloppy Sam before leaving him. She deserves it, so don't miss.
As Gina and Harriet, in their white uniforms, kneel beside the sobbing, bleeding RN on her hands and knees, and while everyone else's attention is there too, Sam winds up, just as he did on that long-ago day in 1970, lets fly, and throws his first strike in over 40 years.
In more ways than one.
The 20-ounce chunk of quartz-shot granite strikes Georgia Rue dead in the mouth, shattering her jaw in 5 places and all but 4 of her teeth. She goes reeling back against the plate glass window, her jaw sagging grotesquely almost to her chest, her yawning mouth pouring blood. An instant later, 2 more rocks fly, one from Ricky Killian, one from Randall. Ricky's connects with the back of Bill Allnut's head and knocks the janitor to the pavement, not far from Ginny Tomlinson. Shit, Ricky thinks, I was supposed to hit a fucking cop. Not only were those his orders, it's sort of what he's always wanted to do. Randall's aim is better. He nails Mel Searles square in the forehead. Mel goes down like a bag of mail. There is a pause, a moment of indrawn breath. Think of a car teetering on 2 wheels, deciding whether or not to go over. See Rose Twitchell looking around, bewildered and frightened, not sure what's happening, let alone what to do about it. See Anson put his arm around her waist. Listen to Georgia Rue howl through her hanging mouth, her cries weirdly like the sound the wind makes slipping across the waxed string of a tin can moose blower. Blood pours over her lacerated tongue as she hollers. See the reinforcements. Toby Whalen and Rupert Libby, he's Piper's cousin, though she doesn't brag on the connection, are first to arrive on the scene. They survey it, then hang back. Next comes Linda Everett. She's on foot with another part-time cop, Marty Arsenault, puffing along in her wake. She starts to push through the crowd, but Marty, who didn't even put on his uniform this morning, just rolled out of bed and slipped into an old pair of blue jeans, grabs her by the shoulder. Linda almost breaks away from him, then thinks of her daughters. Ashamed of her own cowardice, she allows Marty to lead her over to where Roop and Toby are watching developments. Of these 4, only Roop is wearing a gun this morning. And would he shoot? Balls, he would. He can see his own wife in that crowd, holding hands with her mother. The mother-in-law Roop wouldn't have minded shooting. See Julia arrive just behind Linda and Marty, gasping for breath but already grabbing her camera, dropping the lens cap in her hurry to start shooting. See Frank DeLesseps kneel down beside Mel just in time to avoid another rock, which whizzes over his head and shatters a hole in one of the supermarket doors. Then someone yells. Who will never be known? Not even the sex of the shouter will ever be agreed upon, although most think a woman. And Rose will tell Anson later she's almost sure it was Lissa Jameson. Get them! Someone else bellows, groceries! And the crowd surges forward. Freddie Denton fires his pistol once into the air. Then he lowers it, in his panic about to empty it into the crowd. Before he can, someone wrests it from his hand. He goes down, shouting in pain. Then the toe of a big old farmer's boot, Alden Dinsmore's, connects with his temple. The lights don't go completely out for Officer Denton, but they dim considerably. And by the time they come back up to bright, the great supermarket riot is over. Blood seeps through the bandage on Carter Thibodeau's shoulder and small rosettes are blooming on his blue shirt, but he is, for the time being at least, unaware of the pain. He makes no attempt to run. He sets his feet and unloads on the first person to come into range. This happens to be Charles Stubby Norman, who runs the antique shop on the 117 edge of town. And Stubby drops, clutching his spouting mouth. Get back, you fucks! Carter snarls. Back, you sons of bitches! No looting! Get back! Marta Edmonds, Rusty's babysitter, tries to help Stubby, and gets a Frank the Lesseps fist to the cheekbone for her pains. She staggers, holding the side of her face and looking unbelievingly at the young man who has just hit her, and is then knocked flat, with Stubby beneath her, by a wave of charging would-be shoppers. Carter and Frank start punching at them, but they land only 3 blows before they are distracted by a weird, ululating scream. It's the town librarian, her hair hanging around her usually mild face.
She's pushing a line of shopping carts, and she might be screaming, "Banzai!" Frank leaps out of her way, but the carts take care of Carter, sending him flying. He waves his arms, trying to stay up, and might actually manage to do so, except for George's feet. He trips over them, lands on his